Alaska is once again a scientific frontier. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Changes in our climate and our fisheries are getting a lot more attention now, and this is going to increase. Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@aprn.org. The annual Marine Science Symposium is where the scientists come together to talk, and the public is invited. A preview is coming up straight ahead on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Oh boy, you got that right. Well, here we are, ready for another Marine Science Symposium. These things have been going on for years under various names. It's almost like a meeting that has to happen. They started as the scientific annual scientific meeting of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council years ago, and the scientists who were examining oil spill damages and all the ecosystem factors and so forth in Prince William Sound had an annual meeting where they would disclose their results so the public could hear them and so they could talk to one another. And this has continued as research has increasingly focused on the Bering Sea, the Gulf of Alaska, and now the Arctic. And in recent years, it's been run by the North Pacific Research Board, and Clarence Potsky is the executive director of that board. How are you doing, Clarence?
Well, good morning, Steve. I'm happy to be here. I'm doing just fine.
Clarence is, I'm sure some of our listeners are very familiar with you because we got a lot of fish heads listening to this show. And they know that you ran the North Pacific Fishery Management Council for years as a staffer, not a councilman.
That's right. As a staffer, and I enjoyed my years there, and it helped me give a good feel for fisheries management and what was needed for science.
And this, basically, the funding sources have changed. One time there was the oil spill trustee council, it was the oil spill damage settlement, and that over the years petered out. And then Senator Ted Stevens found a way to use the Dinkum Sands money, which is I don't even want to go into explaining what that is, but essentially it was some litigation over oil leases and so forth, and the state actually lost the case, but the federal government, thanks to Ted Stevens, put the money in an escrow fund that was then to be used for North Pacific research.
That's exactly right, and he set up this unique endowment. You might say it's an endowment, even though it's in the U.S. Treasury, and it's providing a stream of income that the North Pacific Research Board will be able to use for many years to fund marine research off Alaska.
And it's basically most funding agencies are, one of these situations where proposals are solicited, proposals are reviewed, and then the scientists go out and do the work, right?
Yes, we have annual requests for proposals, and we had one just out on the street this last fall, and now we're in the process of getting those proposals reviewed, and the board will make a decision on them come April, and then we can get things in the water normally by the fall. And we have something like 250 projects now over these last 9 years, and over $41 million out on the street in terms of individual projects.
Wow. And a lot of this is concentrated these days on the Bering Sea, but I guess now you're expanding to Arctic and Gulf of Alaska.
Yes, we have a major emphasis on the Bering Sea because that's where a lot of the big, huge industrial fisheries are. We need to make sure it's sustainable. And we have a big program there, which is what we term in our terminology is Integrated Ecosystem Research Program. It's actually a huge historic partnership we have with the National Science Foundation, which totals $52 million. Then we have one that we're just starting now in the Gulf of Alaska. It's called the Gauntlet. It's looking at young of the year groundfish species and what happens to them in terms of their survival. And now we're looking at a new initiative in the Arctic over the coming years.
And no doubt the sources of funding will change. There will be this basic fund, but nonetheless, National Science Foundation is now chipping in. And because of that big lease sale in the Chukchi Sea, there's a lot of research that is going on out there directly related to those lease tracts, And those results are put forward at the Marine Science Symposium. So it's really expanding. And I would think, you know, as time goes on, probably some of the endangered species issues will see research money attached to them.
Yes, no single agency or entity is going to be able to support all the research that's needed out there. And so the Arctic, you're going to need to have some kind of a partnership. You're going to have the North Pacific Research Board, you have the National Science Foundation, you have NOAA, you have USGS, and as you mentioned, you do have these industry scientists such as ConocoPhillips and Shell, and they're putting in millions of dollars up there. And you can't forget that you have what used to be called Minerals Management Service, is now the Bureau of Ocean Energy, and they are putting significant resources into the Arctic.
Yeah. So it's a changing thing. And you've been, what, 9 years with this now?
I've been there since January of 2002.
And now you retire.
I am ready to retire at the end of January, and it's been a thrilling and just a wonderful 9 years for me.
Well, one of the things you're going to do at this symposium, one of the speeches is actually going to be by you, looking back over your 9 years. So that's one attraction. But mm-hmm. It's always my feeling that the public really has no idea of the kind of resources that are available to them at this symposium.
Well, you take a look at it, and you find that there is no other place that you can go to find the concentration of scientists doing research on the marine ecosystems off Alaska. And this is built up from, say, 300 to 400 principal investigators, research scientists that would come in years ago, to now we have something like over 870 scientists and others that are registered for this. The public needs to be there. We're going to be in the Hotel Captain Cook. Room is limited, but come in and grab a seat. You should be there early. It's going to be an absolutely wonderful array of scientists talking about their work, and plus there'll be poster sessions too.
Well, I'll tell you what, the value to me as a science journalist is that I go to national scientific meetings, I go to international scientific meetings, and I cannot tell you the number of times when I've watching somebody at a symposium on one or another issue, and they start talking about things that I know more about than they do because I saw the unpublished results at the conference in Anchorage.
Hey, that's good to hear.
And they're still asking the questions, and the answers haven't been published yet. And they came out here in Anchorage. Now, the other thing that's interesting is that you have all the students. The outreach has definitely gone towards the students, so that the student research is made a point of.
Let me tell you, it's thrilling to watch these students get up there, because we actually have judges in the audience that are looking at their presentations. And more often than not, these students that are giving up, call them amateurs if you want, but they are giving just dazzling presentations. And they've worked on them, they've honed them down, and they do a great job, and it's a great experience for them to see the more senior scientists up there giving their information too.
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact of the matter is, it's free labor. I mean, if you are a professor, you need some good, brilliant graduate students to go out there and actually
make
do
it look
lab
good.
Work and, you know, pull up those grabs and so forth. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do know what you're talking about. They're the ones that are sorting through all the screens right. and stuff out there. Yeah. They got mud on their hands.
Well, speaking of mud on their hands, I want to turn at this point to Fairbanks and Jeremy Mathis, who I've known for a while now. And Jeremy has now got himself, he is an assistant professor of chemical oceanography and director now of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Ocean Acidification Research Center. He joins us by telephone from the university. Jeremy, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I said this is a preview of the conference, and then I find out you're not going to be there.
Unfortunately, this is the first time in 4 years that I will that I'm going to miss it.
But I think you will be missed as well, because you're in a frontier research field that probably 80-90% of the people listening to this program are wondering, wait a minute, ocean acidification, what's that? So,
well, it is. It absolutely has gained quite a bit of media attention in the past couple of years, and that's a good thing. We've worked hard to educate the public because it is a scientific sort of process that's going on that could have implications to the general public in terms of its impact on the fisheries.
Yeah. So you have, thanks to, I guess, mostly federal funding, you now have this center. What has the center managed to do so far?
We do. It was just established just a few months ago in the summer of 2010. But the idea behind it was that we would sort of be an organizational point for the scientific research that was going on, and then also being sort of a repository for the data so that people like yourself or policymakers could go to our site and get some of the synthesis products that we were generating and some of the understanding that we'd be able to put up through websites and through outreach programs. And so at this point, the center was sort of formed out of a number of projects that I had funded, and Clarence just ran through the list of funding agencies, and probably 90% of the agencies, including the North Pacific Research Board that he mentioned, have funded ocean acidification projects around Alaska. And so what I just did is I leveraged all those funded projects that I had into the creation of this center, with the hopes that now that at some point the state will come in with some continuing funding to just sort of provide some basic infrastructure support into what we're doing.
I'm wondering, you know, you always see these measurements. It's not all that hard to measure the temperature of the ocean and the salinity, but apparently acidity is a little bit more tricky. And so it's not so much a case where you can just use vessels of opportunity and, you know, platforms or whatever there is that can go ahead and take your measurements, too. It's not all that simple.
That's exactly right. It is a fairly rigorous chemical measurement that has to be done on the water. But we are working on a program where we're calling it a vessel of opportunity because the fishing fleet has really showed a lot of interest in wanting to help. And so what we plan to do is identify some points of contacts in a number of the fishing communities around the state, and then have them collect water samples for us while they're out just doing sort of their routine daily activities, and then they'll send those water samples back to Fairbanks, and we'll do all the analysis here in the lab, and then the plan is to ultimately have sort of an interactive website so that those guys can go up and actually see the measurements that came from the water that they collected on sort of a map server so that they can start filling in the holes. And because that's our biggest challenge is the spatial coverage that we're dealing with, the vastness of our continental shelf here in Alaska, it's very hard to get multiple occupations or multiple samples from any one site. And so with the help of the fishermen who are out there anyway, I think we can start to fill in some of that spatial variability that we're dealing with to get a better handle on what's going on.
But it is also a temporal variability. And
it is, and so it does vary seasonally, and then that's another case where these guys would really be able to help is having those repeat occupations going out multiple times during the year to the same spot that would allow us to get a handle on those changes that occur throughout the year.
Do you follow fisheries issues very much, Jeremy?
Very closely.
Then it's no secret to you that we seem to have a little Chinook salmon problem.
Yes.
Nobody can answer this question. I understand that. Or even get anywhere near a linkage. But is there at least a possibility that some of the problem, the at-sea problems of our salmon might be tied to some kind of increasing acidity in our cold northern waters?
The potential is definitely there. Ocean acidification is an ecosystem stressor, just like warming temperatures or pollutants or any other thing. Ocean acidification does have the potential to be disruptive in those ecosystems. And so, and you said it, we can't make a definitive link at this point. But going forward, I think ocean acidification, is going to be one of those ecosystem stressors that contributes to those sorts of things.
Yeah, I don't have an expert on this subject here, but I expect that Clarence has heard some of this, and you know, certainly there's going to be a good deal of discussion during the symposium. But there's some changes with the changing temperatures and the changing icing pattern in the Bering Sea, which has really been intriguing because it's been icing more than it used to. We're getting some changes in the kind of plankton we're seeing there, as I understand it. I mean, large changes, large patterns of changes.
You are, but the thing is that you may have a cooling going on right now, but the overall long-term projection is for warming, the recession of the ice, and the loss of the multi-year ice pack up in the Arctic, and probably a northern migration of various species that you would see in the Bering Sea. Some people have said it's like you'll find the Bering Sea ecosystem more prevalent up towards the Chukchi Sea. There are others that say, and with that will carry, say, differences in small versus large copepods that may be good for either keeping energy in the upper water column versus letting it fall to the sea floor, and thus you have a more pelagic community than you do a benthic community. And there's others that have said, Phyllis Dabeneau for one, is it's always going to be cold and dark and icy at most times of the year up in that northern Bering Strait area, and that may act as a curtain or a barrier for the northward movement. But certainly what we need to do as scientists and as funding agencies is make sure we have detection arrays up there that are looking at species movement over a long period of time, and also the types of physical components of the ecosystem, acidification, nutrients, and so on that Jeremy's been talking about.
Good. I'm glad you brought that up, because now we're around to a subject that I think hasn't been reported on at all yet and needs to be, which is the proposal for really an observatory for the Bering Strait region.
Yeah, for talking purposes, and the shorthand is that we call it the Distributed Biological Observatory in that Bering Strait region that would reach from around the St. Lawrence Island all the way up to Point Barrow. And this is going to be an area of tremendous flux and change over the coming years as the ice recedes north. And it's a gateway from the Pacific up to the Arctic for not only small animals, but also for your large ones that subsistence hunters depend on, your whales and your seals and so on and so forth, and corridors for migration of birds and things. And we're also starting to see a lot of some of the Bering Sea stocks, your opilio crab, and a lot more salmon up in the northern part of it, and Pacific cod and small pollock.
I remember Sue Moore talking about hearing gray whales up in the Beaufort Sea under the ice.
Yes, yes.
I mean, we're not talking about everybody loves whales. Whales, we're just talking about they didn't have no idea they were up there in the winter.
I may be mistaken, but I think you're also seeing humpbacks start to go up there too, and spend longer periods, not only off of Alaska in general, but up further in those areas too.
Yeah. For those who don't know, the gray whale is among the whales, they would be the rats of the whale world.
Okay.
Maybe the magpies, they're the ones that get out there and explore the new habitats yeah. as quick as they can and have massive mortality as well as a consequence. Jeremy, I wanted to see if you wanted to chime in on this observatory notion. You've probably been in on some of this discussion.
I have. I think it's a tremendous idea. We've seen throughout the years at these time series sites, there's one that's been maintained off the island of Bermuda in the Atlantic Ocean for many decades, and then the one got started off of Hawaii a couple of decades ago. And that's where we can really start relating climate forcing, the changes that we're seeing in climate, to actual processes that are going on in the ocean. And this distributed biological observatory is going to be just that. It will be an opportunity for us to really start to build a long-term time series in a place where there's a tremendous amount of change that's going to be happening in the very near future.
Well, I'm wondering, the Bering Strait's actually, 50 miles or something like that? It's an international border. Isn't there a border issue there? Isn't that one of the things that's been holding up research?
There is, you know, obviously half of it belongs to Russia, but
they get the more nutrients on that side too.
They do. The nutrient-rich water is on, or traditionally on the Russian side. On the U.S. side is the very fresh sort of nutrient-limited water that's coming out mainly from the Yukon River, that Alaska coastal stream that's bringing up low salinity river water. But there are programs that are underway. There's something called the Rusalka program, which is a joint sort of scientific operation between the United States and Russia, where scientists from both countries go out usually every year. They do some big process work, and then they go out in the following year and deploy moorings. But they operate on both sides of Bering Strait and then moving up through the Chukchi Sea. So there is international collaboration that's starting to occur, and that's what we're going to need. It's in the best interest of both countries to have a really good understanding of what's going on there. So I think we'll see more of that in the future.
I think, Margaret Williams of World Wildlife Fund, that's been working with Russian scientists for years now, has characterized it basically as a situation where the scientists are good, but the money ain't all that good. And it seems that that's kind of the thing that we have been dealing with, is that their resources have just been very limited over there with what they could do a lot with what they get, but they don't get that much.
That's exactly right, and that's why the partnerships are very beneficial. The Russians are great. They have a tremendous icebreaking fleet, and so a lot of times, using their vessels and putting some of our science personnel on board to work with their scientists is a win-win for everybody involved.
I've noticed there at the University of Alaska Fairbanks that you have an increasing number of Russian names on your faculty there.
I don't know about that specifically, but we do have some Russian scientists here, particularly in the International Arctic Research Center at IARC. There are several very good Russian scientists over there.
This has been something that sort of occurred over time, where there's been a kind of a scientific cross-fertilization across Beringia, and it's been very interesting to me to watch, to the point where, you know, I remember I used to talk to Russian researchers, and they just, it was like they were in a different universe than the American scientists. American science tended to be sort of reductionist and very specific and not want to speculate. And the Russians were exactly the opposite, where they had a huge theory and they were looking for evidence.
You know, I think it's this partnership that Jeremy talked about, Rusalka. You have some principal investigators on that. Two of them are Lee Cooper and Jackie Grebmeyer. They've done a lot of benthic work up there. They work very, very closely with a fellow named Sarenko from Russia, and who is just a world expert on the taxonomy of these benthic organisms. And they work very closely together. And I think we have to face the fact that to get into Russian waters and do research over there, you do need to have the permits, and you are most likely going to be using Russian vessels and have Russian principal investigators on board. And I think that there's been huge progress over this last 20 years in working with Russian scientists and producing good scientific results.
Well, I was looking at some of the abstracts. One thing that just happened, that all the presentations at the Marine Science Symposium are so nicely organized, and all the researchers have to put forth an abstract that hopefully explains a little bit of what they're going to talk about. Yep. And one of them of interest was of walrus, because, of course, there's great concern about walrus and the female walrus and calves and the diminishing ice in the Chukchi Sea. And this last field season, all this observation from the Russian and the American side, which used to be very, very difficult to, it was very spotty, is much more comprehensive now. And they can say, you know, with these female walruses and their calves, that they all went over to the Russian side.
Well, that's a great segue from what we were talking about in terms of Russian scientists, because the North Pacific Research Board, Steve, just a couple of years ago, we actually funded a Russian scientist, and it doesn't take all that much money because of their different standard of living and their different wage scales over there, that we funded this a gal to study the communities over on the Chukotka Peninsula and look at certain diseases within the meat itself that's being used there and how it's being, I think it was trichinosis or something like that, within there. But we've also gotten reports where you have walrus ganging up on shore because you do not have the ice as a resting area close by. They've been ganging up on shore in the Chukotka Peninsula. And I think it's also happening on our peninsulas too up there on our shoreline. And what happens is when these animals start to stampede, if they get startled for some reason, they run over their young and can kill them. And so people are watching this very closely and trying to figure out what are going to be the impacts of, say, ice recession on the walrus populations.
Oh, yeah. There's huge mortality of calves that, you know, mm-hmm. that's pretty well documented. It's putting the numbers to it and the scale of it, you know,
well,
just,
face it,
a lot of work.
These animals have to feed, too. They have to dive down to the bottom. They have a very rich resource up there in the southern Chukchi Sea, Bering Strait area, a rich benthic resource, and they have to be able to dive down to get it.
Right.
If the ice recedes north and they're floating with it and hooked onto it and cannot get down there, their food source is getting lost to them.
Right. So increasingly is foraging from shore, which probably isn't anywhere near as efficient, but that's one of those things that we're just guessing.
Mm-hmm.
Like with so much.
Well, remember, you have a lot of walrus that were down on in the southeast part of the Bering Sea, outside mm-hmm. Bristol Bay. There was a Cape Pierce and Round Island, and so on. So, they obviously have gotten used to this, but still, we got to keep a close eye on it.
Jeremy Mathis, when can we expect maybe to see a little bit more results? You had such startling results about a year ago, as I recall, because you got to make some measurements up there in the Beaufort. But of course, they were spotty, but they were still scary. You got anything more to share with us, or some time when we might expect some stuff?
Well, we are working on it right now. We had a huge field program this year, but in my lab, I think we had over 400 sea days this year. So I have some very exhausted graduate students and technicians. because we took, I think we ended up with about 4,800 samples that we collected from the Gulf of Alaska all the way up to the Beaufort Sea, to the Mackenzie outflow of the Beaufort Sea. And so we got a tremendous amount of coverage this year, and so that's what we're doing right now is we're working on processing all that data and getting it written up into a form that we can present. So we're hoping by next year's Marine Science Symposium we'll have a very comprehensive story to tell about what was going on in 2010 around Alaska. I do have a student who will be presenting her work. We had an experiment looking at the impact of ocean acidification on early life stage pollock, and so she'll be presenting some of her results at the symposium. She'll do a poster in one of the poster sessions and talking about what she found with the pollock. So that'll be our representation this year at the symposium, but next year we'll have a number of hopefully talks and posters up talking about what was going on in 2010.
Clarence?
Yeah, Jeremy, at one of the conferences I went to, saw some presentations where the Chinese, the Japanese, Koreans, that they are sending research vessels up through Bering Strait, and I think they're taking some rather long transects, not only in the Bering Strait area, but all the way down to the South Pacific for acidification studies. Can you tell us, will you be able to get your hands on that data? Are you talking to those scientists?
I am collaborating with both the Chinese and the Koreans on those projects. I'm in an organization called the Pacific Arctic Group, or PAG, and it's led by a man named John Calder at NOAA. And John's role has sort of to bring the Pacific Arctic nations together in some scientific collaborations. And so I've gone to a number of meetings in China to sort of coordinate with the Chinese, and then also working with a colleague named Sang Lee in Korea to do just that. And so we're sharing information, we're sharing resources, and we're sharing data because we're all doing occupations at different times in different places. And so it's mutually beneficial for us to share this knowledge. And so we are working on that, and it has been a very productive collaboration so far. So we plan to continue that into the future. The Chinese and the Koreans both have brand new icebreakers that they're just taking up now for the first time into those regions.
Right, Steve. And that PAG group that Jeremy's talking about, I think they just met in Tokyo in mid-December. And this is going to be a great nexus for scientists from the different places to come together, these different countries that are interested in that whole distributed biological observatory area, to come together, share their data, share their analysis, and further our knowledge of what's going on up there.
That's exactly right. This DBO, this biological observatory, really came out of the sort of the original PAG effort for the leadership from people like John Calder and Jackie Grebmeier. We're really spearheading that out of that PAG group.
And I would just let me add, Steve, is at our Alaska Marine Science Symposium next week, I was noticing on Friday that there's going to be a workshop on the DBO and what the needs are for it in terms of research.
Yes, I think Jackie is giving an hour-long sort of overview. So I think for anybody that's interested in it, that would be the opportunity to really go and hear it from the person who's been working on it for her entire career, basically. She spent in that region. So it would be a great opportunity.
Yeah, she's the expert. It's 1:30 to 3:30 on Friday.
Thank you very much, Jeremy Mathis, for prying yourself away from your busy schedule. I know you got to go to a 10:30 meeting, so we'll let
you
go.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you guys.
All right. Well, we'll definitely be back in touch, and especially when your results come out sometime next year. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook. When you file online for your PFD, you can donate to any of 40 Alaska organizations that provide healthcare services for those who might otherwise go without. Get more with your PFD when you pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation and Providence Health Services Alaska.
It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We're talking about the upcoming Marine Science Symposium with Clarence Potsky, who's the executive director for another few weeks of the North Pacific Research Board. We had Jeremy Mathis of the Ocean Acidification Research Center, University of Alaska Fairbanks, with us. And we're going to, if you go to the APRN website, and click on the Talk of Alaska icon. We'll try and have, we'll collect a bunch of links here. If you want to pursue any of this stuff further, you can sort of go down some kind of a chain of links as they do these days on the internet. I know we'll put Jeremy's up there. And although, you know, there's not going to be new results probably till next year, but still, it's a fascinating program. And the background of ocean acidification is one that all Alaskans, I'm afraid, are going to have to become more familiar with. Clarence Potsky, what are they going to do without you? Does the board select a new executive director, or has that person already been found?
Person's already been found. Cynthia Suchman from National Science Foundation. She will be out there at the symposium next week. And, of course, we have a marvelous staff that's going to work with the board to carry on and move forward into new marine research areas in the coming years.
I've noticed that during the symposium, you have the most endurance of any attendee. I see you sitting in the front like the number one fan, as if you were at a movie or something. You seem to be really personally, I'm serious about this. This really seems to grab you.
It does, along with management issues. And I'm very interested to, my long-term goal was just to make sure as well as I could, having worked in the fisheries management arena with the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, is they need really good science. Senator Stevens always wanted them to have good science to keep the fish stocks sustainable, to be able to know what the impacts are of fisheries on other components of the ecosystem. And Senator Stevens provided the funding for that. And so I'm always interested in the discussions of our scientists, the directions they're going. But I'd like, as far as I'm concerned, I really like looking at the overall marine ecosystem, but I also want to make sure that our policies are based on sound science.
Well, going all the way back to your council days, I think you probably have already met Michelle Ridgway, yes?
Yes, many years ago.
Michelle, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning, Steve and Clarence.
Hi, Steve.
Michelle, I should explain for our listeners, was on the scientific panel of the North Pacific Council, and you are now with Oceanus, and you have managed to get yourself operating a remotely operated submarine, and sometimes a vehicle they actually get inside and explore canyons with, as I understand it.
That's right. I've been, since leaving the council process after nearly a decade, I've been focusing more on long-term research interests in the deep sea off of Alaskan shores. And yes, our favorite tool is submarines, as well as the robotic remotely operated vehicles.
And you get to do a presentation at the Marine Science Symposium. Maybe you can give us some preview or some idea of what we're going to, what you're going to be talking about. I assume you have slides or maybe even some videos.
I will. I'll be presenting sort of a standard format at the Marine Science Symposium, slides, and I'll probably incorporate a video clip or two since we've had the great luxury of being able to see some of the deep sea habitats up close and in person. Like to share glimpses of the deep sea ecosystems, especially those that are just south of the region that Jeremy and Clarence have been speaking about, the Bering Sea Shelf, which is extremely well studied. We've been taking a look going off the deep end, if you will, going off the Bering Sea Slope region into some of the most magnificent undersea canyons on the planet.
Now, I understand that you have with you a taxonomist. And for those who don't know what a taxonomist is, that is a person that figures out where a species fits among the other species. That would sort of indicate, Michelle, that you're finding some new species down there in the canyon.
Well, we've been looking at results of some in situ submarine surveys from two canyons, Pribilof and Zemchug Canyon, over the last couple of years. And yes, we rely very heavily on taxonomic specialists. In fact, specimens from those canyons have been sent to specialists around the world, but we're very fortunate to have one of the world's experts on especially certain species, the mollusks, right here in Fairbanks. Nora Foster is here in the studio with me today.
Nora, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much.
Nora, have you seen any mollusks that have been turned up by Michelle's crafts here that you'd never seen before?
Oh, yes, I have. There's a beautiful, about fist-size orange snail. It's one of those that has a soft shell, internal shell, called an epistobranch. And it's in the family Bertellidae or Pleuroblanchidae. Brilliant orange. And the only ones that we know of nearest to it, both in its distribution and their appearance, aren't known north of southeast Alaska and certainly aren't known from those depths. So I've seen it... images of it. I've shown it to other experts, and they say it either fits into one or two genera, neither of which are known from that North Pacific area, and certainly not at those depths. But the video of it is remarkable. Shows its habitat, shows its how many there are kind of per square meters. So it's a lovely animal. I do hope I have the opportunity to study it further.
Michelle, I think at this point I'm going to play the adventures of Michelle Ridgway. Maybe you can explain, because I think you've heard this, but essentially you're apparently in a submersible and basically you're attacked by a squid. Is that right?
Well, I did just hear what the clip that you're referring to this morning, and what I believe... yes, I was in a submersible. When you're doing field work in Alaska, as Clarence or any of these people involved in Northern Research know, when you're in the field, it provides a tremendous opportunity to see up close and personally what's going on in these habitats, and sometimes there are certainly surprises. And going into uncharted waters of the largest undersea canyon in the world, we certainly encountered some surprises. So the video or the audio clip you'll play, I believe, is... when, much to my surprise, I found myself in the below the scattering layer in a very dense aggregation of squid.
So what we'll hear is basically your commentary as you deal with these creatures. Go ahead, Dave.
It's absolutely incredible. I'm over 100 feet. I've got a school of Dahl's porpoise diving down from the surface to play with me. It's absolutely fantastic. It's cold. It's cold down here. Wow. The squid life is pretty phenomenal. Quite an abundance down here. Dropping down through the water column in Zemchug Canyon. Some crustacean, medusa, an occasional arrow worm. And it looks like I'm into the squid. I've got some inking going on here. And unfortunately, I have intercepted some squid in my thrusters already. Wow. Woohoo! This is great. There are so many squid in the vicinity. I'm going to try and get through these squid without jamming a thruster. We'll see what happens. This is crazy. These guys, these squid are adhesing themselves to my cameras, to my lights, to the dome, inking me. It is definitely an aggressive environment down here.
Did you end up with your thrusters jammed up? Were we getting a whole lot of calamari distributed in the ocean here?
We did. We got a major calamari situation developed, unfortunately. You know, squid are a major player in the ecosystem in the Bering Sea, and despite all the studies of squid aggregations and our knowledge that they occur in very discrete layers, seeing them and being in it is a very different experience. Yes, squid, like their cousins, the octopus, have a hard part. They have a beak that's very similar to the beak of a parrot. And when you get so many thousand squid trying to make their way through these submarine thrusters, which are basically like propellers of such, they did jam. It didn't jam until I was down at about 1,300 feet, and the sub was disabled at that point for propulsion.
So how did you manage to regain the surface?
In the submersibles, the deep workers we were using that year, there are several means to regain altitude, if you will. Thankfully, we have pressurized air tanks and voids within our battery compartments that allow us to fill those voids, basically purge seawater, ballast water from those voids with air and resurface. In this particular case, I did that. The problem certainly is that you then have no control over where you're going. So I'm in close contact with the ship. I could not direct myself in any way, so I slowly rose to the surface on air. I didn't have to release my lead, my weight belt, if you will, my lead block, because that would have required me to surface like a torpedo. The air situation allowed me to surface fairly safely, and then the ship sent a raft, a rubber raft, high-speed rubber raft over to hook up a tow line and tow me back to the ship safely. So all was well.
That sounds like an adventure. When did that happen?
That was in early 2007, in the summer of 2007.
Wow. So you'll have a presentation on your latest explorations, and I assume, are they done? Do you get a chance to do more?
I'll be presenting again a lot of follow-up work from 2007 expeditions, as well as subsequent work not in the canyons by submersible, but some hydrographic survey work that's been done. We've managed to put together a lot of information provided by, in fact, as a result of some of the work Clarence has funded. The Healy has taken hydrographic data, allowing us to map these canyons in fine scales. I'll be talking about the geomorphology of the canyons as well as the biodiversity within the canyons. And as far as upcoming expedition, yes, we hope to return to not only Pribilof and Zemchug Canyon, but to the Arctic's massive canyon, Barrow Canyon, this summer.
Okay, can we get a phone call in here? All right, well, we'll do this one first and then come back to you, Michelle, in a moment. Clarence, you may be able to answer Robert here, who joins us from Shishmaref. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Robert. Oh, Robert's gone anyway. All right, then we can go to the Pribilof call. Karen on St. George Island, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Well, thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, go right ahead, please.
I just would like to know if Michelle can help to sort of clarify, is there a real connection between Pribilof Canyon and our productivity here at the Pribilof Islands with our, northern fur seals, all the seabirds, and the massive amount of incredible wildlife that we have around the islands.
Yeah, for those who don't know, you have so many, you got St. George, you got St. Paul, and St. George really has more birds than St. Paul does, which is that's all diving, right?
We have a lot of seabirds because we have the cliffs. St. Paul has the fur seals because they have the better beach area for the fur seals to breed. So it's kind of a habitat selection between the two islands. But I guess I would like to know, could we make a conclusion that there's a link between the canyon and this productivity?
Okay, let's see what if we get a little theory out of Michelle Ridgeway here. Thank you, Karen, for your call. We're going to hang up on you now. Well, we'll leave you on for now, but we got a bad hum on your line, so turn it down. Yeah, Michelle.
Well, this has been a huge question. Of course, Karen's calling from that small island archipelago that's called the Galapagos of the North. It's extraordinarily rich. We also know, based on satellite tagging data for seabirds, fur seals, and sea lions, as well as many whales, and commercial fishing activity is so focused on these canyons that we know there's tremendous productivity coming out of the head of Pribilof Canyon. Dr. Phyllis Stabenow has certainly hypothesized, using her mastery of ocean physics, that waters are clearly flowing from a deep ocean basin at 4,000 meters up through Pribilof Canyon and basically spewing this really enriched seawater right up and bathing the shores of these islands. So there's certainly, not my hypothesis per se, but that of many scientists have worked in the region, that there is this connection, and that Pribilof Canyon is part of this Pribilof domain, super rich region. Now, our own submersible work in the region does support that notion. We've seen halibut and king crab that are species that migrate seasonally for various reproductive reasons between shallow and deep areas. They may move to avoid cold water, and based on some of Jeremy's work, they may also be able to adapt to acidification levels in the seawater. So we're thinking that canyons could possibly serve as a sort of a refugia for species that need to find the right acidification level and temperature level. But we do know that physically creatures are moving back and forth between the shallow and deep portions of the Pribilof domain.
Wow. Yeah, thank you. Clarence, I wonder if there's anything you want to chip in on the issue of the canyons here.
Oh, it's a big issue, and we have had studies out there and along the Aleutians and in the canyons. Michelle is doing very good work out there. These are very rich refugias, as she said, and they have a lot of structure in them. They have many, many, many species of corals and sponges and other epibenthic structure that provide protection for small fish. And we have studies going on out there trying to determine, are the canyons that much different than, say, the slope next to them? Is there something peculiar about the canyons? We do know that they're a reservoir of nutrient-rich water that does come up on the shelf and feed what could otherwise be not a very nutrient-rich shelf. So these are big areas that they need more study. They need submersibles. They need good sampling. And also, I want to put a plug in here for Nora Foster and the work she does, because I've been involved with the Census of Marine Life, and we have a very large shortage of taxonomists in the United States, and it's not getting the support it needs, and we need more taxonomic experts to be able to look at these species and figure out how they're different from each other, and to look at the new species that we know are out there to be found in the ocean.
And it would seem that also, Nora, that what you see also is like, it's just not known where certain species are. In other words, what you're seeing in the samples that you're looking at is new areas where you didn't know a certain species existed.
Exactly. And that's one of the very interesting things about the Bering Sea is there's just these crossroads of species. We get things that are no more in the Arctic and up into the as far as to the North Atlantic. We have species that are found as far south as Baja California in the Beringian area. So that aspect of it is very interesting to me.
And Michelle, I wanted to flip back to you. She brought up Beringia, and I understand you've got another presentation with regards to this?
I do, actually. I'll be presenting a poster with the National Park Service, Beringian Heritage Program. They have taken on an ambitious project, which basically involves developing a new fine-scale map of what is undersea Beringia. Of course, Beringia is the Bering land bridge, and that shallow portion of the shelf that once connected North America with Asia is now submerged. But through many research efforts, there's been patches of it mapped in fine scale and other regions where the only seafloor depth data we have is from Captain Cook's lead line depth surveys. So the Park Service has decided to put some resources toward developing a new map of what the whole place looks like and then making that bathymetric data set available for all researchers interested in the region, either for biological sciences, geological sciences, or most exciting to the Beringia program, archaeological research.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because I correspond with the researcher who's got some younger Dryas speculation with regards to some of those scarring that's found undersea, glacial scarring way offshore in the Chukchi. I'm dying to see the mapping of that.
With the Park Service, we'll be presenting this poster of who some of the contributing entities have been. Certainly the NOAA ship Fairweather, Rainier, have done some tremendous seafloor mapping, as well as Coast Guard Cutter Healy on their various funded missions.
Right. Yeah.
So we'll be showing kind of an update of where we are with development of this map and inviting more partners to share data they have, as well as tap into the database that the Park Service is developing. And we're going to be also sort of highlighting a little bit of a very exciting view of the beach, if you will, at the last glacial maximum. New technology using multi-beam transducers, which is basically a sonar system, provides not only depth data, but the backscatter component of the sonar lets us basically see the seafloor. And using that technology, we were able to run some track lines over basically the area that was last exposed during the last ice age.
Oh, and, man, I'm loving this, Michelle. I gotta get a good look at this one. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Michelle Ridgway. We kind of got a bad connection there, and I think we'll let you go at this point. But thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
All right, and you too, Nora Foster. Very, very enjoyable and quite
thank
the adventure.
You very much.
Quite the adventure as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
Oh boy, I got this one from David by email. I was on the water between Point Hope and Barter Island and points in between for 4 months this past year. To add to the mix, king crab are showing up at Point Hope. Whether they're in the past, I know not. This is from villagers, including last year's marine mammal observer who was from Point Hope. One of our contacts in the village told us where to drop a pot. Unfortunately, this was not allowed under our contract. I witnessed substantially sized salmon at Prudhoe Bay, both jumping and swimming alongside in 2008. Was not able to identify specifically, but I guess Oncorhynchus kita doggies. Chum, yes?
I don't keep them.
None observed this year. Could be timing or sporadic runs, although our marine mammal observer from Wainwright said they've been around for some time. I never noticed them at Prudhoe in the mid-70s. I was really impressed by the new-to-me jellyfish species, drifting ball. Everybody's impressed by the jellyfish. I could just tell you that. Marine researchers are impressed with the jellyfish. They come, they go, but mostly they're coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the problem with jellyfish, too, is also when you're fishing in the Bering Sea and you get jellyfish in your net,
brr,
it tends to cut down on the catch.
That's a good cut down on your hands.
Yes.
Well, let's go back to Robert, I think, has managed to reestablish connection from Shishmaref with his question. Robert, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, good morning. This is an interesting program you got here.
Well, thank you. Yes, there's so much to talk about in so little time.
Well, you know, I had a question. You know, I wanted to know exactly how many different pods of walrus are we talking about? You know, that the ones that rest in the southeast, and then you got some on the Buford on the Russia side. But then again, exactly how many pods of walrus are we talking about?
Yeah, that's the big question, I think, Clarence, isn't it? I mean, it numbers is what is the hardest thing to come by. Robert, we got a hum on your line, so you have to listen on the radio.
Yeah, I can't really offer much insight on that. I mean, the walrus are all over. When we were up there on the Healy going up by St. Lawrence, you would see single walrus way out on the ice by themselves. And, of course, as you get further north there, you find pods of walrus hanging onto the ice, I'm sure, Robert, as you've seen up there. What the distinct populations up there, genetic stocks, I don't know. But we just hope that in the long run that they will be able to adapt to this climate change coming up.
Yeah, and generally speaking, in terms of the numbers, it's very much an open question, but they're doing better at it than they had. The remote sensing is much better than it once was. Aircraft, there's more aircraft passes, and there's been more tagging, and so there's more data than they used to have. And the one thing that we do know is that they have been sort of tending to go more over to the Russian side, still going onshore, still with unknown mortality among the calves. And that's basically the short answer, I guess. Wow, this has been really something. Clarence Potsky, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I wonder if you got a little parting shot. You got about a minute.
Well, I just hope that people will continue to support research up here. I hope they will learn from the different meetings that we have from the symposium, the types of things that you do, Steve, to get the information out there. There's a lot going on off of Alaska. We have a real rich resource here, and we need to keep it that way.
Yeah, and this has so much implications, as you brought out, to our fisheries, but also because we do know that we have changing things in our climate and so forth. You know, we've got to have sensing out there to know where we're going and how to deal with it.
That's right.
If only how to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Clarence, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Nora Deans. Thanks also to Jerry at KUAC for connections with Michelle Ridgway and Nora Foster, Jeremy Mathis. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Finn Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at finnair.com. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state governments since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.